From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Baltimore is seeing a 40% increase in homicides and a 60% increase in shootings this year compared to the same time last year. What's causing the spike, and how can it be eliminated? We asked Tessa Hill Aston of the NAACP and City Councilman Brandon Scott. Then, some of Baltimore's most iconic gay bars have closed or will soon. We talk about the role of gay bars in gay life with the owner of the Mount Vernon neighborhood's Grand Central and with the program coordinator of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center of Baltimore and Central Maryland. Plus, how has sex therapy changed in the last 5 decades? Tom Hall talks with sex therapist Lois Feinblatt at 94, still seeing patients at Johns Hopkins. Now, news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. Hope you're doing well on this beautiful morning. Welcome to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In Baltimore yesterday, 7 people were shot. In the 30 days since Freddie Gray died, more than 30 people have been killed in Baltimore. Some are linking the violence to fewer arrests by Baltimore police following the charges against the 6 police officers involved in Gray's arrests. They say police are less active. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake responded to those claims at a press conference earlier this week.
People have said, well, it's because morale is down, or it's because the officers were charged. We don't know that.
And the violence of the past 30 days is not new. Since the beginning of the year, homicides are up 40% and shootings up 60% over the same period last year. So what's driving the surge in violent crime, and how can it be stopped? With me by phone to give his perspective is Brandon Scott, a Baltimore City Councilman. He represents parts of East Baltimore. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Steele. Thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio is Tessa Hill Aston, president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP.
Welcome. Good morning. Good morning.
We reached out to the Baltimore Police Department as well. They did not make anyone available for an interview. Tessa Hill Aston, your organization, the NAACP, has opened an office near Gilmore Homes in Sandtown Winchester neighborhood where Freddie Gray was arrested.
Yes.
What are you hearing from residents there about this spike in crime?
Well, most of the people have said, aside from the crime, they want help, and most of them have been young men from teenage up to 30 or 40 years old, saying that they want hope, they want help in order not to be victims themselves or not to be in the drug trade. Some of them have been, and some of them are trying to stop or have stopped. This is not something that someone else has said, but a lot of times when there's been slow business in the drug trade in a community because of the curfew and different things, people are picking up speed. There could be times when people have, for lack of better words, ripped each other off. I mean, it was slow times. Things could happen where there's feuds with people who have different corners of different blocks. And sometimes crime happens as a result of people having feuds. It's unfortunate, but that's the reality of the streets.
So feuds may be part of this. You say the men you talk to, the young men,
yes,
say they need help. What,
yeah,
what do they point to?
Well, they point to their criminal record, and not always a bad criminal record. When I say criminal, it could have been a traffic. It could have been something. It's not minor, but they could have had a marijuana joint a long time ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, and they didn't take the time to get expungement, or either they went to someone and it cost too much money, they didn't have the money. So that's the number one thing that we have on our list to do, is to help everyone who needs expungement to do that. We've gotten 2 people cleared last week of their previous charges, and they were all 3 women that we help. Minor things. It could have been shoplifting. Things that happened 5, 10 years ago, but it's hindering them from jobs. One lady got a job, they found out about her record, and then she got released from the position after a month of serving the job well. So we're trying to help people with the problems that they have in this community and any community, that if they get their lives in order, they can move forth, and that takes them away from the drugs. It takes them away from the criminal element of doing things that they didn't want to do in the first place. And that's what people are saying.
So it's working on their criminal record, and
Anything else that they
Well, they're saying jobs. The men want jobs. They're saying that they don't want to be on the corner. Some people, some men are babysitting and watching their children or a relative's child. There's some good men that are doing the right thing. They just don't have any money. And so they're standing outside talking to people. Everybody that's on a corner is not a criminal. And some of them don't even have criminal records, but they don't have jobs because they haven't been in any kind of skill level. So we're going to try to answer those questions. Those who want help, we're willing to help them if they step forward. And we hope that when we help some and people see the results of their lives, that others would be encouraged to also get help.
Brandon Scott, you represent neighborhoods in East Baltimore. What are you hearing from residents there?
Well, I represent neighborhoods in Northeast Baltimore and some in Southeast Baltimore. For me, I mean, what we're hearing, actually, we had an unfortunate incident in a neighborhood not too far from mine last night where a young woman was shot. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing in Baltimore, and folks are trying to tie this around the great incident, but like you said in the opening, Sheila, homicides and shootings were up before that. And for us and folks like myself and folks like Tessa, this isn't something new. This is something that we've all been working on for a long time in our city. And what we're seeing is that we still have a lot of places where they get this deep-rooted violence. And yes, a lot of it is attributed to the drug trade, but a lot of it isn't. Also, we're having people shot over minor and small disputes, which leads to something that, you know, we have to want better, and we have to have a value of life in our communities, because some of these people are dying over things that are so minor that have nothing to do with drugs or guns. They have nothing to do with turf wars. We have to get to the root problems of those things as human beings as well. But what you're seeing is we had a perfect storm of events. You know, we had the incidents with the Gray incident. You have the police working, you know, 20, 24-hour shifts. And then when you have what happened during all of that, there's some elements of the street that feel like now they have the opportunity, or they had a small window to go out there and do as they please. So we have that, but we still have police working. You know, I had my local commander here sends out a email to his constituents every week, and every week he lists out incidents where communities, people have called the police that led to some significant arrest. And one of them in particular was about a robbery. There was an armed robbery of someone on Moravia Road. Someone called 911. They were able to find the car and find the people almost immediately. There's something similar where someone was shooting off a gun, and they were able to find the people with the gun, you know, somewhere near the park. So the police are still working, but it has to be, again, we have to stop going to these questions about the police. Is it about arrests are down? Well, we already know, historically in Baltimore, some of the years when we had our highest numbers of arrests, we also had our highest number of murders, and vice versa. Some years when we had low numbers of arrests, we had our lowest numbers of murders. So for me, we can't get to this conversation where we're going to be talking about, oh, we need to arrest more people, because we've been there before. It's not about the quantity of the arrests, it's the quality of the arrests. What are they being arrested for? What are they being arrested with? Are they being arrested for minor and petty stuff that has nothing to do with violence, or are we arresting people that actually are out there committing the violence, because we know that's what works, not just mass arrests of people?
That's Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott here on Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also with us is Tessa Hill Aston, president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. We're talking about the surge in crime of Baltimore of late. So, Councilman Scott, I read what you just said as you are not drawing a connection that because of the charges against the six police officers, there's a slowdown in attitude among police. You think police are still trying to keep the streets safe.
Yeah, I mean, the ones I interact with, now, could some of them be mad? Of course, but that's human nature. But I think that at the end of the day, they know they have a job to do, and they are prideful in their jobs. The overwhelming majority of them are prideful in their jobs. But also, again, as I keep saying, Sheila, is that we have to get into, and we have to get out of it just being about them. It has to be about the stuff that Tessa was talking about. It has to be about self-responsibility and involvement in the neighborhoods. In particular, you know that I'm very big on the lack of involvement of a lot of men in our neighborhoods. Those are the kind of things people have to step up and be seen and be heard as well. And we can't always, as someone said to me on another radio show this week, we can't always rely on someone else. We have to rely on ourselves. Also have to look ourselves in the mirror and say, what can I do? What can I do to truly make Baltimore be more?
Tessa Hill Esten, how do we find the right balance of police action in Baltimore neighborhoods?
Well, I think the police do the job, and I don't think they've slacked up on their job. I think sometimes you can't be everywhere, and some of these murders and shootings are times you can't predict where they're going to happen. There's a difference of shootings and crime than people standing on corners selling drugs. I think that they should go after people who are selling drugs and hurting people and violent offenders. I'm of the opinion that we should not go after the drug addict. I don't like when a drug addict gets locked up when they're buying $5 or $10 on a corner and they get taken to jail and then it gets charges dropped because it was such a small quantity. That's the person we should be trying to engage and bring into some services and get them in drug treatment. And that's the person we can try to correct their lives to prevent some of these things. So we just got to keep working to get people to have self-esteem that they don't want to be in jail and they don't want to be dead. And that's what some of the men have said. There's only two choices when you live in that kind of environment and work in that environment with drugs, is that one day you're either going to be dead or one day you're going to go to jail. And those are not two good options.
Yeah, there's no 60-year-old retired drug dealers. They don't exist.
No, they don't exist. Not like that.
Councilman Scott, you are a founder of the 300-Man March, which certainly has focused on trying to interrupt black-on-black crime. I think I read recently that a couple of dozen more volunteers joined up recently. Do you have enough to make an impact? I mean, do you really see this making a difference?
We have enough to make an impact, but we could have a greater impact if more men answer the call and realize their duty as men to protect their neighborhoods. We were able to, so we focus in Bella Edison from June to September for our street engagement unit every year. The year before, we were there every Friday, went constantly during the week, wherever we were there. Bella Edison saw, you know, over a dozen homicides and shootings. Last summer when we were there, they saw a combined two. And it's not just about us. We know that the Bella Edison Community Association has been doing a lot more work. We know that Bella Edison Neighborhood Incorporated has done a lot more work. The police there have done a lot more work. Citizens have done a lot more work. There's programming there through schools like AFIA and all these other schools in the neighborhood. It's about a collaborative of everyone working together, and we're just a part of that. And we know that we can have a greater impact if we had more. We would love, look, Sheila, the call for 300 men is still the call. We want to have 10 groups of 30 men who want to go into the 10 most violent neighborhoods in the city and constantly be a present. But we have not gotten the answer for that.
Brandon Scott, I'm going to interrupt to give Tessa the last 30 seconds. We're heading into the summer, which is often a high crime time. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that a lot of times in some neighborhoods where there's crime, and I used to work at Gilmore Homes, a lot of times I know for a fact that a lot of times when people get arrested on property and public housing, they don't live there. They're passing through and using that as a place to do their business. So public housing is not always the problem. It's the people who pass through and use it as their place to do business. And so I just hope that people who want to do better step to the plate and get help and all the resources that are out there.
We'll leave it on that note. Thank you both. Brandon Scott. Baltimore City
Thank
Councilman
you.
Tessa Hill Esten, president of the Baltimore chapter of the NAACP. We reached out to the Baltimore Police Department, who did not make anyone available for an interview. But Police Commissioner Anthony Batts is scheduled to talk to reporters about the spike in violence later this morning. It's 88.1. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Some are iconic destinations for LGBT customers for decades, but gay bars are closing at a notable pace. The Quest in Canton closed a year ago. The Eagle, a leather bar in the 2000 block of North Charles Street, has been shuttered for more than 2 years. Recently came word that the Hippo, which started 43 years ago in Mount Vernon as a disco club, would close and make way for a CVS. And patrons of Jay's on Reed, a piano bar, expect it to close as well. What does the closing of these bars mean for Baltimore's gay community? And what does it tell us about how the situation of gays has changed? When Tom Hall asked John Waters his thoughts about the Hippo's closing, the film director and writer had a lot to say.
In Baltimore, I have always gone to mixed bars. To me, the coolest gay kids today don't want to go to a gay bar. They want to go to the hip bar where it's straight and gay people mixing. For the progress of gay acceptance, all gay bars are eventually going to vanish. It's like saying a black bar. Who wants to go to a black bar? You know, so basically, the Hippo was definitely the center of gay Baltimore. I have gone there, certainly. Straight people went there to dance, too. It was a great dance
bar. I went there all the time, yeah. Especially when I was working at the Opera Company.
Yeah.
That's where we went
all
the time.
People love to go there and dance. It's sad that it's leaving, but it is not surprising in a way. Even in New York, there are few gay bars left because not only do young people want to be with all kinds of people, this Grindr thing, you know, everybody's looking online. They'll be in a gay bar, but they don't know what cruising is. If somebody said, like, pulled up to next to somebody looking in a shop window and said, "Hi, what are you doing?" They say, "Get away from me. Why are you talking to me?" They wouldn't even know what that meant, cruising. Cruising is, there's no such thing anymore. They don't know what it is. It's like a thing from another era.
John Waters talking to Tom Hall. We want to continue the conversation now with Don Davis, who owns Grand Central, a bar in Mount Vernon that he calls an alternative club. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Lonnie Walker, program coordinator for the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center of Baltimore and Central Maryland, which was founded in 1975. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Don Davis, when did you come to Baltimore, and when did you open Grand Central?
I come to Baltimore in 1976. I had a partner that was from Baltimore. He lived in New Jersey with me for, I guess, about a year, and then he wanted to come back home. So I moved here in 76, and then in 1986, I opened the Allegro up, November 6, 1986, and I was there for about 7 years. I sold that in 93, but I had opened Grand Central, which was Central Station at the time before I expanded, in 1991.
At that time, how important were gay bars?
Well, 29, 30 years ago, there was approximately at least 20 gay bars in the Baltimore region, which now we're down to about three or four of them, with now the Hippo closing. I mean, I've been going to the Hippo since 1976. It's an era that's sad, and there's a lot of memories there. What I've seen is, I have to agree with John Walters a little bit about the demographics of the whole country have been changing. People are feeling more comfortable. They're on the internet now, and on different sites of meeting people online. That has changed a lot. As John said, the Grindr, the Growler, the gay.com, the manhunts, and people are finding meeting people online is a lot less inexpensive and a lot easier. And then the fact with the gay marriage, you know, I think most straight people have gay friends, and now gays or straights are feeling more comfortable with going out with their straight friends to straight places. And that's curtailed business a lot. And that, you know, it's just the demographics have changed. It's a whole different market today. I've always built, even when I opened the Allegro and Grand Central, I've always built it out, not a gay bar. I've built it out as an alternative club.
Let me pull Lonnie Walker into the conversation. Focus for me, Lonnie, on young gay people. I mean, if they're looking for a welcoming community, do you think they need still places like gay bars?
No, not anymore. Like Donna said, the times are changing. You know, I know for me at 43, when I go out, I'm more comfortable in a gay bar because I'm 43. But when we talk about our younger generation, where it's becoming more and more acceptable, they're comfortable at any bar, whether it's gay or straight. So the times are changing, and they're gravitating more towards the straight bars, and they're having a wonderful time, and they're accepting them there.
John Waters used the analogy of if you had a bar only for black patrons, no one would want to go there, which implies a stigma to a gay bar. Lonnie, do you see it that way?
That is a stigma. It is a stigma, but it's real. It's reality, and it's the truth. It happens. I mean, there are black bars here in Baltimore. There are black gay clubs here in Baltimore that you have very, very limited number of Caucasian males that go, and a large number of African Americans. So that stigma still exists.
So when you hear John Waters say, he didn't say soon, but as a matter of progress, all gay bars eventually are going to vanish.
Oh, yes. I'm from New York, and I mean, it's so hard to find a gay bar in New York. And Christopher Street used to be lined up with gay bars, but they are vanishing.
On WYPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Lonnie Walker, program coordinator of GLBT Community Center here in Baltimore, and with Don Davis, owner of the Mount Vernon Bar Grand Central. We're talking about the evolution of gay gathering places in the Baltimore region. Don Davis, what keeps Grand Central in business?
I think, again, as I've always built it out as an alternative club. I've never really built it out as a gay bar. And that was years ago. We'd have a lot of straight females that would come in, felt very comfortable there, not being hit on, knowing that, you know, they were somewhat protected. Straight guys would not come in. It was sort of a stigma type problem. But today, with the acceptance, more and more acceptance, everybody's feeling comfortable. And I think what's happening throughout the sweep of the country, because of the demographic change that's taken place, that more and more people are feeling more comfortable going to, out with their straight friends to straight places. But if you build it out, and a lot of these gay owners who have been around for years throughout the country have only known gay. They've only had gay customers. And now, with me always building it out as an alternative club, I've been reaching out, and I'm reaching out even more. So I'm getting a very collective crowd that comes in.
Lonnie Walker, some people have said that Baltimore no longer has a gayborhood.
No, I mean, it's changing. Well, they call the Mount Vernon area the gayborhood, and it's actually changing. And I think it's changing for the good, because not everybody's welcome. You don't have to be gay to be in the gayborhood. You can be straight and walk in the gayborhood. You can be gay. You can be transgender. I mean, it's open for everyone. But one thing about the neighborhood is we still have the GLCCB, which has been around for 40 years, and we're not going anywhere. You know, it's here. It's here to stay, and we will still have a Baltimore Pride every year.
If you don't have social clubs that are a place where gay people know they're going to meet other gay people, why are they also interested, or why are you so sure they're not going to lose interest in something like your organization?
Well, it's because it's a safe space. Our organization caters to the youth, the elderly, and the middle class, and the middle age. It's a safe space where if you want to come and you need resources, we have resources here. And just like any other community center, you need resources, and the LGBTQ community needs a resource center, and we are a resource center, just like you have the recreational centers for other programs. This is a resource center.
Don Davis, what do you find that your patrons are looking for?
My patrons, again, it's a very mixed crowd now, and you have to create different theme nights to make it interesting. I mean, you just can't have somebody thinking they're going to come out on the street and just sit at a tavern. I have a very unique club that I've spent a lot of money in. I've had architects, designers do it, put a lot of money in it through the years, took a lot of pride in it, the cleanliness of it, the atmosphere of it, inside and out. And doing different theme nights, karaoke a couple nights a week, piano night, it's bringing a crush of all ages into the club, which makes it exciting. And as long as you keep things exciting, keep reaching out, building it as an alternative club, things are getting better. So I'm not where I was years ago with business. Things have curtailed, but I'm holding my own. I'm doing better than what most people because of the attitude I've always taken place.
I've gone to Grand Central several times, and I love Grand Central. And the unique thing about Grand Central is it has so many areas in there to where you can go and party in very various areas and still have an awesome time, whether you're straight, gay, bisexual, transgender, or anything. So that's the unique thing about Grand Central. It's open to everyone.
Are the changes that you're seeing entirely generational? Are you seeing young people wanting something very different from middle-aged and older?
Yes, young people, they don't see the lifestyle in the same eyes that we see the lifestyle in. They want to go out and they want to have a good time. They don't want to be labeled, so they don't necessarily have to go to a club and it's identified as a gay club. They're just going out to have a good time.
And I agree with Lonnie on that. It's, again, the demographics have changed so much that as long as you create the excitement, my club started out years ago when I opened Central Station back in 91, was predominantly the baby boomers. And I can remember the younger kids would say, oh, I'm not going in there, it's all the old people. And then through the years, the transition, the older people now that, you know, they have mortgages and beach houses and going to the theater and dinner parties, they've stopped coming out. So a lot of it's the younger. But now I'm finding by being so diverse and doing different theme nights, it's bringing a lot of the older ones back out. So it's a good mix of everybody. As Lonnie said, with transgenders, you know, straight people, black people, Hispanics, it's a good mix of everybody, and it's like one big family. Everybody
right.
gets along, and it's very acceptable today. And I think it's the best thing. I mean, I don't like to see the gay community diminished from the times Lonnie and I remember, but I think it's better this way now that there is the acceptance out there. People are feeling comfortable to go out with their friends anywhere they go, and that's the way it should have always been. And I'm glad to see it's happening like that day. But you have to be innovative, and which I have been, to reach out, to create the excitement, to open up my doors for everyone, than to just consider myself a gay bar 29 years ago.
Lonnie?
I mean, let's say, what gay person did not dream of ever wanting to go to a space where everyone can go and be comfortable? You know, you don't want to go out and be identified as, well, I'm going to the gay bar. No, I'm going out to hang out with my friends, whether they're straight, gay, or bisexual, and we can all party together. So this is what we've wanted for years, and it's here now. So to say that the gayborhood is leaving, no, we're transitioning. We're not leaving. The gayborhood is not going anywhere. We're just transitioning. The times are changing. And now everyone's welcome into the gayborhood. So if my straight homeboys, as we would call them, want to come out to the bar with me, and they say, well, you know, are there going to be any girls there? There are going to be plenty of girls there, and they're straight. They don't have to worry about anyone hitting on them.
Is this happening in other cities, too?
It's happening. It's been happening in New York. You know, it's in D.C., it's in New York, it's in Atlanta. It's happening all over.
I do a lot of traveling. Of course, I have a place in St. Petersburg. I lived in Fort Lauderdale during the winter months. And I'm finding in your resort areas, sort of Rehoboth or D.C., which is very transient, you know, the nation's capital. Yeah, most of the bars are holding their own there because of being so transient, being the capital of Florida. So many people have moved, gay people have moved there. The bars are holding their own there for the most part, is what I've found. Like Rehoboth, they're holding their own. It's still not like it was years ago, but because of the amount of people that are vacationing in Florida, the amount of people retired to Florida, the bars seem to be holding their own. But through the rest of the company, our country, I do see a great sweep that, again, if somebody, quote, owned a gay club and that's all they knew was a gay club, they don't know how to get out of it, and one by one they've been closing up through the years because of the transition of what's been happening and the acceptance of what's been happening. But I've looked at this thing, like I said, 29 years ago at a different way, which it's paid off for me now.
It's like Don said, you have to be innovative and creative. And if there's not one thing I know about gay people, we are innovative and we are creative. And if we can stay that way, we can have a club, a bar, a restaurant, and we don't have to have that label on it, and it can still be successful.
Well, thank you for walking us through it. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheila.
Thank you.
Don Davis is owner of the Mount Vernon Bar Grand Central. Lonnie Walker is program coordinator of the Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center, GLCCB, in Baltimore. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, ahead on Maryland Morning. Impressive accomplishment in the Baltimore Jewish Hall of Fame. Stay with us on 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome back. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Tonight at the Gordon Center for the Performing Arts in Owings Mills, the Jewish Community Center of Greater Baltimore will induct 10 people into the Jewish Hall of Fame, recognizing their work in community service, business, medicine, law, and the arts. The inductees include a few people who are being honored posthumously, including Rabbi Mark Loeb, who led the Bethel congregation for many years, Lynn Meyerhoff, who supported Johns Hopkins Hospital and many other causes, and Irving Blum, a real estate developer and philanthropist. The other day, I visited the beautiful North Baltimore home of Lois Blum Feinblatt, who was married to Irving Blum for 32 years and who is herself also being inducted into the Jewish Hall of Fame tonight. She celebrated her 94th birthday on Sunday. In the mid-1960s, after working for 9 years as a social worker in the Baltimore City Department of Welfare and Adoptions, she began working in the Sexual Behaviors Consultation Unit at Johns Hopkins Medicine, where she has been for more than 40 years and where she still sees patients. Lois Feinblatt talked about how her career as a sex therapist began.
Well, it was really very interesting. A friend of mine saw a column in the Baltimore Sun that said, Hopkins to train housewives to be therapists. And she brought the little article over and she said, I think this sounds like you. I think that this is something you would like to do. And actually, it was a, I guess, a wonderful idea. It had been tried at NIMH in 1960, and this was now, as you say, 1966. And it was an expensive program for the institution that was going to have that program. And so just any little place couldn't do it, but Hopkins thought that they could. And 400 women applied. You had to be 35 or older. You had to have just a college degree, no other degree. And you had to be what they called successfully married, whatever that was, and have raised a family. And they were really the only requirements.
And you ended up working in the Sexual Behaviors Consultation Unit. When you entered the program, was it specific to being, as everyone has called you now for all these years, a sex therapist, or was it more broad than that? And then did you decide to focus in this one area eventually?
Well, when we had our training, which was 2 years of training, mentoring training, in other words, the doctors at the hospital gave their time. We were given patients very early, and we had 2 hours of seeing patients and 1 hour of supervision, which was quite intense. There wasn't any sexual behaviors clinic at that time. And then I think we finished our training in 68, and then we had a year of internship, and then Masters and Johnson came to Hopkins too. They were, on the scene at that time. And everybody went to hear them. I no athlete, but I had to get on top of the baby grand piano just in order to have a seat to hear them. And they were fascinating. And a group decided that it was time for Hopkins to have a sexual behaviors clinic. They were actually popping up all over the country at the time. And so ours was one of the first. And somebody that I knew said, Lois, would you like to try your hand at that? It was interesting because a lot of people thought they were interested in it, and a lot of people dropped out. But I stuck with it, and I've had quite a wonderful career through it.
What about this particular dimension of psychotherapy has sustained your interest for all these years?
Well, first of all, it is constantly changing. I do wish that we would, we wrote one book, our clinic did about 20 years ago, I think, and but it's such a changing field now. As you all have probably been reading in the paper, there's a whole lot about transgender people. That was fairly new. What had happened was that it was at the time of what you called women's liberation, and women began to be a little bit more conscious of and demanding of more pleasure for themselves. That was a kind of a new idea. So we just went with the flow, and whatever came our way. The fascinating thing is that I still go almost every Friday afternoon, and I get out of there and I think, no, that's not possible. I didn't hear a new kind of a problem today, but I did.
Still after all these years. So, and the problems are a little bit different than now than they were in the 60s or 70s. Has sex therapy changed, in lots of different ways?
It has changed, I think, because the world has changed. And there was an article in yesterday's paper, quite shocking article, about the women, very apparently wealthy class of women who live in the upper east side of New York. And the shocking thing was that these women have a relationship with their husbands, which in our years at the Sexual Behaviors Clinic, that's exactly what is the opposite. of what we were seeing. Now, do things go around and come around? These women who's, it said in the New York Times, they, if they are successful in how they run their household or in getting their children into the proper daycare, their husbands reward them at the end of the year with some kind of cash flow so they can then buy their clothes or whatever. And that is just not at all the way things seem to be going. But maybe it shows that things have become a circle. I don't know. It was a pretty shocking article to me.
Lois Blum-Feinblatt, she is one of 10 people being inducted tonight into the Jewish Hall of Fame. Others include the filmmaker Barry Levinson, businessman Henry Rosenberg Jr., and Lawrence Katz. He's the former dean of the University of Baltimore Law School. We'll have a complete list of all of the inductees on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. The ceremony is tonight at 7 o'clock at the Gordon Center for the Performing Arts in Owings Mills. Lois Feinblatt, happy birthday, and thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for seeing me. I always enjoy talking with you, Tom.
Reporting from North Baltimore for WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio.
WIPR in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1830, the first railroad timetable was printed in the Baltimore Patriot for the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The B&O was the country's first intercity railroad and the first to offer scheduled freight and passenger service. We're scheduled to be back Friday, and we hope you'll join us.